Good evening, everybody. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. I've been thinking about it, and one theme we could use for this week, we still have a president. Remember that guy? If you forgot he was there, you only had to look for him in the bleachers at the Olympics for like the first 3 days or something, which is kind of amazing. And he kept giving China a hard time, which I kind of liked, since NBC seems like they might as well be reporting from Disneyland. But there was even bigger stuff on his plate, of course. What could feel more nostalgically presidential than dealing with a Russian invasion of something? Here he is this morning in the Rose Garden.
With its actions in recent days, Russia has damaged its credibility and its relations with the nations of the free world. Bullying and intimidation are not acceptable ways to conduct foreign policy in the 21st century.
Yeah, take it from us. He also locked down a missile defense deal with Poland, finally. Newsweek runs a very timely cover called What Bush Got Right. Then yesterday, he signs two very big, important bills, one that outlaws lead in kids' toys, it's about time, and the other we'll talk about a little bit later in the show. First, though, the dominant news of the week, of course, came from Central Asia, the small Republic of Georgia. Russia has taken over two Georgian regions along its border and possibly taken over other parts of the country as well. Believe who you want, but one thing is clear. Russia's planning on hanging out for a bit. Condoleezza Rice, U.S. Secretary of State, got to Georgia today and said there that that's not going to work. Russia needs to get out and get out completely. Americans are using air and sea support to get humanitarian supplies into the place, but we're not flashing our sword just yet. In Russia, this was about protecting ethnic Russians, Russian citizens in some cases, who want to break away from Georgia. And on TV there, this is a grand and justified success.
The picture says it all. The Georgian president cowering from a Russian helicopter, David hiding his face from Goliath as the battle is won.
I don't know if they have a different version, maybe, of the David and Goliath story over there, where Goliath is the good guy. But in any case, on the David side of things, in Georgia, there is real fear and a sense of violation in a country that's been independent now for 17 years. The supposed ceasefire worked out earlier this week doesn't sound like it's been good for very much. Andro Dadiani is a Georgian, lives in Tbilisi, the capital, and works for a nonprofit there. We have him on the phone with us from Tbilisi. Mr. Dadiani, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Jeff.
What is happening there right now? What are you seeing? What are you hearing?
There's obviously not the tension that it's been a few days ago when explosions could be heard, even in the capital. But it's far from feeling safe. If you stand in the neighborhood gatherings and listen to people, it's all about, are the Russians going to leave? What's going to happen to Abkhazia, South Ossetia? Are the refugees going to return back to their homes?
Living in the capital, what kind of an attachment do you feel to these regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, that are in dispute?
Oh, you have to know Georgia and Georgians. First of all, it's a very small country, and most of the people have friends and relatives from these places. People are very attached to this territory. It's parts of them feeling Georgian, if you know what I mean.
What has this done, all of this, to your sort of sense of the identity of the country, the sanctity of your borders?
It has brought a huge humiliation. It's a huge pain that these beautiful pieces of land that always belonged to us suddenly can become no more ours.
Help us understand, why is humiliation the word that you choose to describe the feeling here?
Because it's someone, an outsider, someone that is stronger and bigger, just deciding one day that it's not yours anymore. It's also humiliation, literally, because, you know, my relatives lived in Gori, and they were kicked out, and their houses are now being looted.
Gori is a town in the northern part of the country, right, closer to Russia?
Yeah, it's just terrible.
So our Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, is in Georgia now and says all Russian troops need to leave the country. Our response so far has been diplomatic. Maybe some Georgians were expecting something more from the U.S. and from the West. Do Georgians feel neglected at all by the West?
Everyone is very frustrated that there is no more, no physical involvement of the West. However, the latest statements of George W. and Condoleezza Rice's visit have really increased the hopes of people that it will just not stand as it is now, and Russia will have to leave, and Georgian territorial integrity is going to be unharmed. However, the people are very frustrated that not more than this has happened.
The Russians say that Mikhail Saakashvili, your president, was asking for a fight by asserting his control over these two regions. Globally, I think at least there's some sense he may have been overconfident. Are people there blaming Saakashvili at all?
Well, I would say not yet. Saakashvili may have overreacted or being overconfident, but people believe that he's done it for the right cause.
You said not yet. Do you expect opinion will turn at some point?
It might. For the time being, everybody is united around this problem. But if these efforts do not succeed, those frustrated will start blaming this government for their troubles.
I have to ask, would it be so bad if Russia took control of Abkhazia and South Ossetia? I mean, could that make this whole thing, for the rest of you, who live in the capital, say, could it make this whole thing go away?
Well, there is a sort of a logical analysis, and there is a Georgian standpoint of it. I don't think it will make the conflict go away, because I don't think the Georgians would ever agree to Russia being the controller of these territories. It's the principal issue, it's the historic issue, it's the issue related to Georgian identity and dignity. I don't think this will make the problem go.
Andro Dadiani, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Andro Dadiani was talking with us from Tbilisi, Georgia. Stick with us. Later in the show, we'll give you our own in-the-loop style take on Russia's statement on the world stage. You are listening to The Week online at minnesotapublicradio.org/in-the-loop. I know that's confusing. We're working on it. I'm Jeff Horwich. And at least Georgia can kick a little tail at the Olympics, you know? Looking at the medal count, they've got 2 golds in judo and Greco-Roman wrestling, and 1 bronze in the 10-meter air pistol. Russia got the silver. Let's talk Olympics for a bit here. First of all, have you been following the story of this, what's his name, this Michael Phelps guy? If you haven't, it's really remarkable. It's a, how could you not know, right? Look, I get it. He's a great swimmer, maybe the best. He's gonna win a lot of medals. Now show me something more interesting than semifinal heats in the breaststroke. I watched a lot of Olympics this week, mostly in prime time, and one thing that's bugging me a little bit is, rather than show me a broad spectrum of humanity and sport, NBC seems to want to show the same stuff again and again and again. One particular women's beach volleyball team, Michael Phelps, usually with his pants barely on, and a completely inappropriate amount of synchronized diving. Where did that sport even come from? One of our listeners, Craig Kenworthy, has been watching quite a bit this week as well, and today he delivered to us this delightful reflective poem.
How do they sing in Beijing? Like Milli Vanilli, only using small kids with better teeth. As our women, some ancient, at 18 and 20, bounced away the team title but took the solo gold. While underage Chinese, are those baby teeth? Tumbled through air you could see, and Phelps' wake grew. Even swallowing Jonah might not slow his liquid march to the top of the podium. Still, Georgia beat Russia, even if it was only in beach volleyball. As the late Isaac Hayes might have put it to Putin, can you dig it?
That's Craig Kenworthy. He listens to the podcast in Bozeman, Montana. If you find yourself poetically inspired by the week's news, send it our way. Craig alluded to the lip-syncing during the opening ceremonies. The little girl whose voice we heard was judged not cute enough to be on TV. Here's what else we now know. Those awesome footprint fireworks seen from above springing up all over Beijing? Fake. Computer animation. and the children, representing all of China's many ethnicities. They were all ethnic Han Chinese, it turns out, which is the country's dominant ethnic group. A lot of people have said we could never pull off an opening ceremonies like that. In hindsight, maybe that's okay. On a somewhat more positive note, one of the treats for me so far has been watching Bela Karoly. This is the former gymnastics coach, and now he's this completely over-the-top partisan commentator. First of all, he's so excited that a lot of what he has to say is just downright unintelligible.
The Chinese qualified first by a significant margin. Is there reason for the U.S. to be concerned?
Concern is always a legitimate concern, but they're under umbrella of protection, protective umbrella.
Yeah, when you can understand him, Karoly is out there on his own throwing bombs like no sports commentator I've ever heard. One minute, he's specifically accusing the judge from Argentina of cheating. The next, he's back on this question of underage Chinese gymnasts. They're supposed to be 16, but some on the Chinese team, which won the gold, look more like 12.
That is this obvious, it's documented. Half of the Chinese team is underage. But nobody could really prove why, because they have the passport given by the government, and that's pretty much it.
I think this raises some big questions about the role of sports commentators. Is this journalism, what they're doing? Do they need to back up what they have to say or give some kind of balance, you know, until the story gets sorted out? This is a developing story at this point. Some documents have allegedly turned up now showing Bela Karoly may be right. Anyway, here's looking forward to the next week of the Olympics and some different sports on TV, I hope. Go world. This is The Week from In the Loop, and I am Jeff Horwich. We have got a standing call for listeners who track a particular area of news to come in to the show and fill us in. Aaron Lacey listens to the In the Loop podcast out in Washington, D.C., where he's an attorney specializing in higher education. Aaron, thanks very much for giving us a bit of time.
Glad to be here, Jeff.
So this week you wrote in to say the president has just signed into law on Thursday, as a matter of fact, kind of the mother of all higher ed bills. What exactly are we talking about here?
Well, it's the Higher Education Act, and you know, it was supposed to happen about 6 years ago, but it took them forever, as it usually does on the Hill, to get around to actually getting it passed. This is the big bill that dictates the terms of all those federal loans and grants that college students get. So this tells you who's eligible, how much money they can get, and how often they can get it.
So this thing is, about 1,200 pages long, I think?
It's huge.
So we'll have to simplify it a little bit. You and I know, both have pretty new babies, and I think it's supposed to cost something like $1 million or something by the time they have to go to college.
Yeah, if we're lucky.
Yeah, what does this act do about that problem?
Well, I don't know how much it's going to help our kids, given that that's so far away. But the theme of the act really has been to make college more affordable, and the act's hoping to do that right now to the extent it can. They're calling out expensive colleges. And what I mean by that is they're going to ask colleges every year to provide the Department of Education with statistics regarding their cost and how the cost breaks down. And they're also going to track who has the biggest increases. If you are a repeat offender and you have one of the higher tuition increases over a number of years, then they're going to put you up on their website so that everybody can see.
So you might, scary.
Yeah, you might think of it as keeping costs down through public humiliation. They've also increased the actual amount of money that students can get, and this is a big deal. You know, there are a couple of things students have access to. One is student loans. The other is grants, which is just money in your pocket. The Pell Grant's the main instrument, and traditionally have been around $4,000. They're going to increase that to $6,000 in 2009 and eventually get it up to about $8,000.
And the act is also supposed to make student loans more transparent somehow, right?
Well, that's right. Colleges are going to have to give students more information about available loan providers. So that's the different banks out there that will give them the loans. Also, information is going to have to be included about loan terms, interest rates, and federal aid in general. In other words, a student's going to be able to go out and see exactly what the interest rates are going to be and the different benefits and compare and shop smarter.
So this is one of those huge omnibus kind of bills, and a lot of interests want to try and slip their little something in there. The film and music industry got a little something special into this higher education bill. What is that?
Well, as you probably know, illegal downloading is a huge problem on college campuses. I mean, I remember Napster had come along in my last year of law school, and we had law students, sort of ironically, who were mobilizing to download round the clock. music off of Napster. The new law is really aimed at trying to get colleges and universities to crack down on that kind of behavior, and they're going to require these institutions, first of all, to have a policy or plan in place and to implement certain types of technological deterrence. They're also going to require these schools to disclose these plans to the students and to let the students know that if they violate the school's plan, they may also violate federal law for that matter and could end up with a fine or jail time.
Just getting back to the cost question, the biggest piece of this, you think all these changes are going to make college more affordable in the end?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and there are a lot of critics of this act out there. And, you know, ironically, what a lot of people are saying is that you've got so many new requirements that colleges are going to have to comply with that they're going to end up spending more money to put all these new requirements into effect, and that's just going to raise tuition, which at the end of the day may make it a wash.
All right, Aaron, thanks a lot.
Hey, you got it. Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
Aaron Lacey is an attorney specializing in higher education issues at the firm Dow Lonis in Washington, D.C. Let's shift gears yet again. Lots of mixed economic news this week. Markets up, then down, sitting more or less steady today. A lot of states got their unemployment figures this week, and it was not very comforting. Along those lines, an article caught my eye a couple of days ago by Wall Street Journal reporter Dana Mattioli. She kind of called out American companies for subtly or not so subtly, tweaking job definitions in hopes of saving money. I think lots of us are seeing this anecdotally, but Dana put her thumb on the bigger trend, and she's with us for a few minutes here to break down the details. Thanks for joining us, Dana.
Thanks for having me.
So it kind of sounds to me like the heart of this is employers getting, I don't know, creative maybe with job titles. What specifically are companies doing?
Well, companies are purposely mislabeling jobs that are mid to senior level. They're labeling them as junior level so that they can get these younger, you know, employees in that make less money. And they're also laying off or firing 2 to 3 people and replacing them with one lower level employee. Whenever there's an economic downturn, companies look for ways to cut costs, and this is one of the most popular ones.
The end equation here is really they're paying less for what they think is more work. Can they just do that?
Legally, they can do that, but, you know, you might be getting more inexperienced people. You might be overwhelming the employee, and it might lead to lots of burnout and bad retention rates.
Can you give me an example here that you've run into, just a particular type of job and the kind of responsibilities that have been crammed together?
Sure. Well, one person I spoke to was looking at marketing jobs for a marketing director position, and then once he got hired, he realized that they weren't going to let him hire his own team. So he wound up taking on the position of, you know, marketing assistant and other marketing junior level positions because they didn't want to give him more manpower and pay more people to help him out.
Something about it feels very kind of like short term, like it might be satisfying for the bottom line, you know, for a little while, but can this really save companies money in the long run?
Yeah, it's definitely a short term fix. They are saving money immediately on salaries and benefits, but in the long run, there's a good chance these people are going to leave, and that affects retention, and then you have to train new people. It's not good financially in the long run.
And I'm thinking about who benefits when something like this is going on at the employee level, and you've got sort of more mid to senior level positions that are being kind of defined down, but more responsibilities are being crammed into them. It seems like this would be better for younger workers who've, you know, got tons of energy and you don't need to pay them a lot.
Yeah, and also some of the younger workers are embracing this because they're giving bigger responsibilities, and it's good for their resume, builds it up a little bit, but you also run the risk of them not being qualified to handle these bigger positions.
And as you said, getting burned out early in their careers.
Only good thing is they're tech savvy and they are willing to take on extra work, but it might be too much.
Is there anything that, you know, an older maybe or a longer-term current employee can do if you're seeing this going on around you?
Well, if you're flexible, going abroad might get you a bigger salary. They're always looking for American expertise, and you can command up to 2 times your salary here right now.
If you're a job seeker and you suspect maybe you're looking at sort of a fishy job description, what can you do?
You should know your market value when you're heading into the whole job search. Either speak to recruiters, or you could look at salary.com or one of those other websites that can help you determine how much you should be making in specific positions. When you get to the interview stage, it might be wise to say something like, you know, this job seems like it might have been consolidated from 2 or 3 jobs. What's been eliminated? And if they say nothing's been eliminated, maybe head the other way because it might be really overwhelming.
And I guess this plays right into kind of American productivity trends. We are accomplishing an incredible amount in a small time, and the downturn in the economy certainly isn't changing that.
Exactly.
All right, Dana Mattioli from The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now, before we end this episode of The Week, let's return to the action in Central Asia. Analysis of Russia's move there widely seems to conclude this is about more than just a few provinces on the Georgian border. This is about making a statement, Russia stepping back onto the world stage. It's a big wake-up call for certainly the U.S. and Europe, but especially Russia's smaller neighbors in the region, former parts of the Soviet Union. And you know, such moments of national bravado will often be commemorated in song. In this case, might go a little something like this.
Have you enjoyed your little country? Has it felt good to beat your chest? You had yourself some cute elections, very precious. Bat your eyelashes at the West. But maybe you got some wrong idea. You get a little bit off track. And lest you forget your mother Russia, yeah, we're popping in to take you back. You've got lots of lovely coastline. Very nice. Important pipelines filled with gas. We could never let you wander. No, no, no. And we'd have told you, if you asked. So we rolled on through your outer regions, and you quickly sounded the retreat. You throw at us this homemade army. My own babushka could defeat. Oh, where were your friends? You thought they'd come when you shout. But I look, you know, I look into their soul. I do. And I see they sit this one out. You can have your little protest. It's okay. I think we've probably made our point. Don't get too big for your papakis, or we'll go Stalin on the joint. So have you enjoyed your little country? I hope you have, because this experiment is through. Yes, Mother Russia is back in business. Welcome to 1922.
Oi!
Well, how's that for trenchant geopolitical analysis? We are produced by Sandon Totten with help this week from Srini Radhakrishna and edited by Kate Smith. We're online at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. You can podcast the show there if you like. I'm Jeff Horwich. We'll see you next week.